other shows, visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org, and subscribe to our podcast. This has been Eco Justice Radio and our show, Blue Latitudes, Uncovering the Ocean's Secrets for a Sustainable Future. Thank you to Dr. Sylvia Earle, the Chumash people from Santa Barbara County for their songs, Amber Sparks and Emily Hazelwood from Blue Latitudes Foundation, and Scott Sporlitter from Matador Network. And thank you to our listeners for joining us. Please connect with us on social media at Eco Justice Radio, SoCal350, and Wilder Utopia. If you like what you've heard and you want others to be informed, subscribe and share the episodes. You have been listening to Eco Justice Radio, a project of SoCal 350, executive producer, myself, Jack Eit, co-host Carrie Kim, and engineer and original music by Blake Quake Beats. And until next time, remember, the power is yours.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
Why I'm all in the ground, I'd root that mountain down, and I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Tune in to KBOO Monday mornings at 9 for the Old Mole Variety Hour, your source for radically democratic news, views, reviews, and interviews, stories of ordinary and extraordinary people working to root down the oppressive institutions of capitalism. That's the Old Mole Variety Hour, Monday mornings at 9.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from the Artist Mentorship Program, presenting the AMP Music Festival, a 3-day music festival uplifting youth experiencing homelessness on October 16th through the 18th. Tickets and info available at amppdx.org.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. This is the Progressive Paige Turner. I'm Marianne Barisonic. On this program, we'll talk about books with the people who wrote them. In 2024, The Atlantic called Charlie Kirk a kingmaker for the right because he was able to bring both young people and wealthy donors to Trump's Republican Party. His organization, Turning Point, had a huge impact on politics in the U.S. His death is being used as a means to silence critics. Many believe his goal was to establish a theocracy and entrench both patriarchy and white supremacy. My guest is Matthew Bode, and his book is The Seven Mountains Mandate, Exposing the Dangerous Plan to Christianize America and Destroy Democracy. Michael, thank you so much for being here.
I'm happy to be here.
What is the Seven Mountains Mandate, and who's promoting it?
Basically, it's the idea to make America into a Christian nation. The Christian nationalism part involves certainly the role of government. Do we want a Christian government run by Christian principles, run by Christians? The Seven Mountains Mandate kind of extends that into other areas, the entire culture. And the mountains are these areas of culture. There's seven of them where they want to create a Christian culture through a Christian consensus, perhaps a very Protestant, evangelical Christian consensus. But in each area, they want to not just promote or influence, or as we've heard from Christians, be salt and light in those areas. They want to control those areas. And it's a minority movement, and I should emphasize that, because they're not interested in mass evangelism. They're not interested in the majority of people claiming Christianity. They want to see the Christian mores and Christian cultural rules and Christian policies and really Christian pressure put upon those cultural institutions to become more Christian. So just for example, the Mountain of Entertainment. It is about not just creating Christian content and selling that in the marketplace. It is about silencing and mocking and trying to end the other voices that have been anti-Christian. They believe that all seven of these mountains, and that includes the Mountain of Religion, are run by anti-Christian forces, forces that don't want them to operate, and they're now responding by trying to take back those forces. Charlie Kirk and Turning Point USA have turned their organization toward this mandate. They've become the heir to this mandate in the last few years, really since the pandemic started.
Are the roots of this movement in white supremacy?
Here and there. The roots of the particular seven mountains date back to the 70s with two leaders and founders of college campus ministries, Bill Bright, who helped found or who did found Campus Crusade for Christ, and a guy named Lauren Cunningham, who founded a global missions organization called Youth with a Mission. And I would not suggest that those two people are white supremacists at all. But over the years, different groups have tried to push the Seven Mountains mandate through different words. Charlie uses he wants to save Western civilization. Other people suggest they want to save Christian culture. But mainly what they are talking about, it is perhaps a very race-influenced culture, that a white evangelical culture. There's a lot of white evangelicals who follow the ideas in the Mountain of Family that they want to promote. I would not suggest that every single person or even the large majority of the people are some sort of white supremacists, but they do see a definition of culture that largely white evangelicals follow. There are plenty of people in the organization that push all races, and some people push female leadership in some areas. And so it's a wide movement, but at the same time, with Charlie Kirk being the heir of it, he is certainly pushing a particular view of culture that he pushes mainly to white evangelicals.
So now you're saying that Charlie Kirk was the heir to this movement. How did that happen?
He met a guy named Rob McCoy, who was a pastor in California of a megachurch there, and who was a Seven Mountains advocate, and they met in roughly 2019. And Rob McCoy had run for office in the state of California and been on his city council, and he had been under the tutelage of someone who was also a Seven Mountains person, kind of passed down through a network of people. And Rob McCoy convinced Charlie, who was already in charge of Turning Point by then, to turn Turning Point into this larger culture war operation. Before 2019, Turning Point was a free market, pro-capitalism, reduce the national debt student movement. After the pandemic, it became much larger to every generation, every age, every demographic. The second person I think that helped Charlie move Turning Point into the Seven Mountains mandate was the person that's labeled its modern father, a guy named Lance Wallnau, who is a Texas entrepreneur. He was a pastor, but he's mainly an entrepreneur because he's been selling the Seven Mountains mandate for 20 years now. He's been traveling the world with a big whiteboard and drawing little mountain peaks and talking about how God gave him this vision of these seven mountains. He got that vision from Lauren Cunningham, the man I mentioned before, who in the 70s came up with this list. So you can see there's a network, there are other people in the network, so it's about passing it down. When I say heir, that's what I mean. It's been passed down from generation to generation, and they've been trying to find people in the next generation to take it on, and Rob McCoy found Charlie Kirk.
A 2024 survey showed that a majority of Christian nationalists would support a leader who is, quote, willing to break some rules. And about a third of those same people support violence in order to save our country or to ensure the rightful leader takes office. More than 80% of those Christian nationalists agree that the final battle between good and evil is upon us. Why has this kind of spiritual war rhetoric been growing in some evangelical circles?
I think it's really from the history of the Seven Mountains mandate. So in early on with Lauren Cunningham and Bill Bright, it was about a sense of influencing these areas to persuade them to become more Christian, just pass certain policies. We think of early Christian conservative groups that tried to influence our democracy through politics. But around the time that Lance Wallnau became aware of this list and made it into the mountains, he's the man credited with the mountain metaphor, he and other people introduced a fervent spiritual warfare that they were not just trying to influence, they were going to war against spiritual elements in America. So they would do prayer walks in urban areas and cities and talk about all the different things that were attacking cities, gang warfare and disease, and higher education became one of them. So part of the change in the Seven Mountains Mandate became spiritual warfare. We were going to take the battle spiritually to the other people. And many people are kind of aware of generally what spiritual warfare is. It's praying over, praying against Satan forces. So then you add now the political emergence of Donald Trump. He becomes the physical manifestation of that spiritual warfare. Donald Trump is known for taking the fight to his enemies. We use the word enemy much more than we do before that. And he is using the government as the power of the Lord in some manners to finish the battle that the Seven Mountains Mandate started. So if you think about spiritual warfare, what it does is it raises the stakes of things. We now have good versus evil, not just in the clouds and in principalities fighting for us. We have it in two political parties. And the enemies that attacked and killed Charlie Kirk, even though one person was arrested for it. So you can see where this could go. The more you talk about it, the more you need a physical manifestation of it, and you got that with Trump, and the more then you ask from that person, the more that they're going to try to deliver. And you can see now with the martyrdom rhetoric of Charlie Kirk, they want to win this war in a physical fashion that perhaps started with spiritual warfare.
What do you think the impact of this spiritual paranoia has had on public discourse?
We essentialize groups of people and make these vague threats from isms and ideology. One of my first book was about the rhetoric of evil, so I have directly knowledge of your question, that when we talk about evil in our society, sometimes it's about extra human things, you know, people that kill other people, they're evil and they're outside of our humanity because of that. But now we've been using it in quite a different fashion, that there is an evil striking at the heart of America. There is isms and ideologies represented by people at times that are threatening to destroy our country. And it is those isms and ideology that we have to erase. And that means erasing and silencing people. It doesn't just mean eradicating knowledge of that ism or ideology. So in the responses in the last week to the brutal murder of Charlie Kirk, we have seen this, we're going after they, and we're going after these vague organizations. And that means at some point they're going to name specific people and specific groups. And this is the culmination, I think, of decades of our political rhetoric in terms of division and sides and lack of unity. It has shown up itself in different ways, but Donald Trump has obviously just turned it up to 100.
Your first introduction to Turning Point was because you had written an opinion piece for Texas's biggest newspaper. Was it Texas?
George's paper. Yeah,
where George's paper, arguing against a law that let people carry concealed guns on college campuses. What happened as a result of that opinion piece?
So back in 2016, when very few people had heard of Turning Point, they tried to go viral, wanted to get known with this list of professors that they didn't like. And it was a collection of articles and opinion pieces and sometimes comments on social media. So I was put on that, as you described, for writing against guns on campus. And because it was early, there was lots of media attention that they did get. Many people volunteered to have their name on the list because as they saw it, it was some sort of McCarthyist list. But at that point, to be honest with you, Turning Point did not have the power that it does today. That first list was 100 people, and maybe I got some terrible emails about it in response to my column. But today, there are 700-800 people on that list. And what happens to them when they get put on that list is much worse. There's certainly an online mob. There's certainly attacks on their person and their communications, and sometimes their classes are looked at. And of course, now we have direct lists of people in their comments being fired for comments about Charlie Kirk's death. So you can see it obviously has risen in power and influence. And the professor watch list is not the only list that Turning Point has. They have a school board watch list. So they're really good at making lists of people. And it's a ready-made set of targets that is, of course, on the internet for people to look up. They were happy to use my wedding photograph. If you go to my bio on there, it's my name, my contact information, why they don't like me. And my particular file has been updated over the years. It is a set of people that they don't like, but it's sort of like we are now part of these larger isms. We are the indoctrination camps of higher education. We are the people that they don't like. They want to try to silence us by pointing us out.
Higher education has definitely been a target of this group. A couple of years ago, Ron DeSantis said he wanted to reshape the new college in Sarasota into another Hillsdale College. You write that Turning Point got their teaching methods from a small private college in Michigan, Hillsdale College. Mm-hmm. What can you tell us about Hillsdale, and how did this college influence Kirk and Turning Point?
You know, before I answer that, I just want to say that this week, New College announced they had raised private donations to build a statue of Charlie Kirk on campus.
Which is a complete departure from what New College had been prior to this reshaping by Ron DeSantis, because it was a very liberal, very tolerant and open college, and it has become anything but. That's interesting. Yeah, you say this week, we're talking on September 17th. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, so, you know, Hillsdale is a private Christian college in Michigan. It's been there for many hundreds of years, and it's most famous for in the 80s when the federal government tried to suggest that if it was going to take federal money for students, for student loan money, that they have to give certain information, demographic information, and the Hillsdale said, okay, we're not going to take your money. So they're most famous for not taking any federal student loan money. They fund their own school in that regard. But it's also famous for, in the last, I don't know, 10, 15 years, of being the epicenter of spreading a curriculum through mainly K through 12 schools, starting with private schools and voucher funded private schools. And they have a network of schools that they send this curriculum to, both literal class by class curriculum, subject by subject, but also larger videos that anyone can watch. And Larry Arnn, who is the president of Hillsdale, was the chairman of Trump's 1776 commission in his first term. Charlie Kirk was the vice chair, I think he was, or at least on the commission of the 1776 commission, which was an educational reform commission. And what they wanted to do was change public school curriculum. And now they're able to do that because of the ways in which Charlie Kirk and Turning Point have attacked public schools. So they don't merely want to take money from public schools and put it in private schools. They want to go back into the public schools and suggest that you should treat this kind of patriotic curriculum that was laid out in the 1776 commission. And by that, throwing in there the Christian origins of America, we were a Christian nation, here's why, but also putting more of morals and values and virtue study into public school curriculum. It may not be directly Christian, but there are places in America like Oklahoma where the public superintendent of education wants to give every public student a Trump Bible. So you can see where this could go. Hillsdale is the epicenter of that. Turning Point learned how to do that from them. So Hillsdale has their own network of schools, and Turning Point has started their own network of schools, and they're generally doing this, I'll give you our curriculum for free if you partner with us.
You're listening to The Progressive Page Turner on KBOO, your member-supported, volunteer-powered community radio station. I'm Marianne Barisonic. My guest is Matthew Bode, and we've been talking about his book, The Seven Mountains Mandate. One of the things that you write about in the book is school vouchers. And you write that supporters of school vouchers aren't just using the policy to save some students from public schools. They're actually defunding the whole thing. What happened in Arizona?
Like many states, Arizona passed a massive voucher legislation. And I mean massive. It expanded its current voucher system, which usually was limited to schools that were failing or certain types of special education students. Now it's every student in the state could apply for a particular pot of money to take with them to a private school. And in fact, it's not even taking with them. Some states, and I forget exactly Arizona's law, but allows people who've never been to a public school, who've never had the experience of a failing school, and I put that in quotation marks, to take their money. Now it's any school, any parent could apply for this amount of money to both send to a private school and also perhaps fund a homeschool. And this caused a massive budget hole in the state of Arizona's budget. There was reports of hundreds of millions of dollars that they would not have because of this. I don't know exactly where it ended up, but there was a large amount of cutting that needed to happen from other areas of state government because of the ways in which they were funding this voucher program. A very similar program is now in play in Georgia. It's much more limited, but there's still a lot of money being taken out of larger school districts to fund private schools and homeschools.
Why are they so opposed to education, both public education and higher education?
I think one answer to the public education question comes from a book, not the only book, but Bill Bright, who I mentioned before, is a founder of the Seven Mountains Mandate Movement, wrote a book in the 80s with a chapter on each of these areas. And in the chapter about education, he talked about the founding nature of education in America. He thought it was Christian based and you should use the Bible to help people read. But he also suggested when public schooling became a thing in the 1800s that they were already introducing secular concepts like Marxism and communism and all the isms we've been hearing, and that started the trend of public schools being bad. Public schools are bad to this group because they introduce secular or anti-Christian forces, and also they claim that they're silencing Christian students who want to speak about their faith, which none of those things are true, but over the years we've come to believe that. In higher education, I do believe that it is an attack upon the professor sort, you know, the people who teach different things, or crazy myths of people going into their first year classes and people disparaging the Bible. It is also, I think, about, in the last few years, of course, about diversity and equity, inclusion, and they don't like that. Everything that deals with woke, there's that. But I think in general, the idea of higher education scares them because it is not tied to promoting the type of culture that they want. There's a reason that higher education is treated differently than K-12, because K-12 is treated as a state entity and you can fund it very directly, whereas higher education has this freedom to go about in different ways. And I think they're afraid of that freedom because it can't be controlled. Curriculum is quite wide ranging. And they do see the professorship as some sort of liberal indoctrination. That's also not true.
And this group, as you said earlier, it's a very small minority. I think there was a statistic in your book where they had done a survey of even Protestant Christians, and only 4% of them would go along with this whole curriculum or this whole ideology. And yet they feel it's their job to make the rest of us go along with their doctrine.
Yeah. And that's why it's an anti-democratic force. And this is why I suggest that in the subtitle of the book, right, it's out to destroy democracy. It may use democratic means to gain power, like electing people. But once they're there, they're going to impose a minority viewpoint on the majority. So again, the Seven Mountains Mandate is a minority movement. They're not interested in mass evangelism. They're interested in their particular people getting up on top of the high places, the phrase that Lance Wall now uses to describe the top of these cultural institutions. So yes, it is a minority movement, a movement with growing adherence in the public. I mean, it's taken over the Republican Party as a strategy for the culture war. It's certainly not in every conservative church in America, mainly charismatic. It has made inroads at the Southern Baptist Convention. But one of the things that Charlie Kirk did well, one of his successes, was translating this into a larger audience without its baggage, all kind of the baggage we just talked about, the spiritual warfare and things like that, so it would be more palatable to those audiences. He's held, if it's mainly started in charismatic churches and things like that, he's held pastor summits with run-of-the-mill average pastors, and he brings in these charismatic people to talk to them, but they don't mention Seven Mountains Mandate. They just get them talking together, and then they subtly and slyly introduce its Christian culture concepts. As they are so set on winning the culture war, so set on this being God's purpose, not just for them, but for the country. They see the anti-democratic forces, as you just mentioned, a certain percent of the population would go along with violence to get the ends because they believe the ends are God's plan for this country.
What is complementarianism?
Complementarianism is, in many ways, the definition of how to run a family. It means that the husband is the leader in the family, the wife is to submit in many ways, and this relationship is about how the church should operate. There should be only male pastors. But what is most interesting about the Seven Mountains Mandate is they want that picture to be the national picture. They want men to go out into the world, protect the country, and the women to essentially stay home and protect the home. But complementarism is the theological mandate in the Mountain of Family. And if your family doesn't meet that definition, you should be canceled or silenced.
In his book, The Case for Christian Nationalism, Stephen Wolfe argued that basically Christians in a Christian state don't need the government's permission to rule. He said a Christian minority can create a political state without the whole population's approval, because he said the Christian's attitude towards the world should be that it belongs to us, not theirs, since we're co-heirs in Christ. So are they calling for a holy war against democracy?
It's kind of unclear about whether they would call it a holy war. They are calling for, and they don't actually believe in democracy. They think what we want to call America a republic, and there's really no difference between the two other people. But a republic stands for certain values, and a republic has a certain cultural code. So yes, they are suggesting, of course, that our democracy, our majority rules, has led us down a road in which our culture is disintegrating, and there's violence, and there's anti-Christian forces. So they're willing to do just about anything, insurrection, to take that culture back. Some people would suggest it's a spiritual war, and I do want to emphasize that. Other people would suggest that it's a political war that you fight in a minority position. But we've seen physical manifestations of this type of talk. And yes, what they're suggesting is they want the kingdom of God on earth in America, that America is God's chosen nation for bringing on the end times, and America should be prepared for that. That is, we should prepare America as a Christian nation so that Jesus could come back and rule. That is very clear.
And if you look at the things that Christ's promoted, it doesn't really fit very well with what they're promoting.
Well, they do like to cherry pick their verses. And I will say, in terms of the pictures of Jesus, Jesus has changed over the years for them. He is not the helping the poor, turning the other cheek. There is a much more muscular Jesus at play here, a Jesus who fights for you, who defends the church, who stands up for truth, these physical actions. Jesus has become the king that they say he is. We are co-heirs with Christ, as Stephen Wolfe said, right? So he is this coming king, and he's going to come with his power of the sword. And so they're suggesting, well, if he's already in that fashion, that we should promote it that way. It is a picture of a masculinity that is about protection and defense and aggression, and not about feminized Jesus. They would not like that.
Do you think this movement has hurt the image of more tolerant and mainstream Christians?
I do think the Turning Point movement and its move to Christian nationalism has hurt Christianity. It has hurt my Christianity. I think that it's made evangelism almost impossible, because once you start talking about the gospel, you are now also forced to talk about their version of everything else. And you are divided into political camps from the get-go, instead of, you know, the four basic spiritual laws that Bill Bright is famous for. I think that it has drawn even more divisive lines in pews and churches, and not just denominations, so that the things that Christians would be united around, or they're now divided around. And if you think about, the audience to non-Christians, I mean, I can't imagine many people suggesting, as you just pointed out, all the things that seem to be opposite or contradictory, they're not agreeing or being persuaded by, because of the pictures presented by Turning Point. But I do say that there are plenty of Christians out there, conservative, progressive, liberal, people who claim the Christian faith that are not in the movement, and they are doing good in their communities across the United States.
We've talked about how this Seven Mountains Mandate is not a really popular doctrine. And from what you're telling me, it sounds like they actually hide parts of it when they're going out and trying to spread this.
Yeah.
But Trump and his regime seem very devoted to this. Do you think he can continue to consolidate power without that popular support? And do you think this movement can be stopped?
I think that Trump is a unique character in this story because he certainly has brought the power of evangelical voters to a higher degree. And Charlie Kirk was a personal friend, and Charlie Kirk worked for his campaign and all those things. I think that the way in which Trump has bulldozed through our government and our Constitution allows for this larger movement to come right in after him. So I think it will depend upon what a post-Trump America looks like. And Charlie Kirk and Turning Point were planning for that.
You're listening to The Progressive Page Turner. My guest has been Matthew Bodie, and we've been talking about his book, The Seven Mountains Mandate. Matthew, thank you so much for talking with me.
I'm happy.
You're listening to Community Radio, KBOO Portland.
There's something curious about this broadcast.